when he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, my best friend and buddy?" He said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel? Is that you?" Why do you say, "Is that you?" Maybe Elijah doesn't look like his pictures anymore. It's been over 3 years. Now, for a number of years, I was using in publicity brochures a picture that I liked that had been taken in Glendale in 1971. And I got to the point where everybody said, "Huh?" You know, I knew the time had come to change, Sam. I couldn't get away with that anymore. Maybe that was a problem. Or maybe the police drawings weren't that good. Ahab had forgotten, you know, the man that really marched into his palace. He was working off 3 years of remembering, you know, the posters, and all they had were the police drawings, the sketches. I don't know. Or maybe he says, "Is that you?" because Ahab is having a hard time still believing that Elijah would really have the courage to show himself. "Is that you? Do you dare?" I don't know. But the three words, "Is that you?" quickly slide by, and we find four more from the wicked king. "You troubler of Israel." In mid-sentence, he changes from a question to an accusation. A straightforward declaration of fault. "You troubler of Israel." You add the three and the four together, and you get that magic mystical number of seven. Seven words. And did you know something? That's all we're going to hear from King Ahab. Just seven words through this entire chapter, the whole Mount Carmel experience. And you know, it is not until he gets back to the royal palace, inside, into the arms of Jezebel, before his tongue is really loose again. You look at the next chapter, 1 Kings chapter 19, verse number 1, and do you see? You see when he opens up and starts talking again? "Now Ahab told Jezebel everything that Elijah had done and how he killed the prophets, blah, 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 blah." You get it? I mean, a lot of water's gone under the dam. And Ahab is quiet through all of this, except for these seven words. "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" You know, for the guy that has been looking for the prophet for 3 years and putting all the efforts that he's been putting into it, and now he finally finds him, you might expect more of a sustained outburst. It reminds me of that old cartoon that I saw of the cannon. You know, the huge cannon and all the firepower. And I mean, it was powerful, and they were lighting the fuse, and the fuse, you know, kind of ticked down, and all of a sudden everybody's ready for the explosion. And instead of the explosion, all it goes is... That's the picture I have of the king at this particular point. Just a puff. "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" Have you ever noticed how easy it is to blame someone else for your own problems? A number of years ago, we were traveling cross country under the pressure of time, long distance trip, and I missed a turn. Ever done that? Oh. And on down the road, a couple of hours, I realized it. And it meant for major problems. I mean, what do? Just admit you've blown 4 hours now, or six, and go back? Or do you find another way? And you get out the map. And in my frustration, I still remember saying, "Sweetheart, why didn't you let me do that?" And then I noticed that she was asleep. It is so easy to blame somebody else for your own problem. We are all far too skillful at shifting the blame, at finding fault in other people. In fact, maybe at one time or another you have been in a predicament, because of this problem, like the seismologist. He was fired because he was always finding fault. Is it you, you troubler of Israel? Seriously now, Ahab's outburst against the prophet was the hissing of the serpent's seed against the body of Christ. It was a demonstration of the fact that it is natural for the wrongdoer to hold the messenger of God responsible for the calamities that come as a sure result of the departure from the way of righteousness. Natural. That means in our sinful nature, you know what? We all do it. We all do it. But now I'd like to ask you to switch for a moment, probably in fact for the rest of our study, and put yourself in Elijah's place, because the focus that I want to work on with you right now is how do you face false accusations when they are made against you? How do you handle it? Have you had any practice? If you grew up in a home with another brother or sister, you probably have. How do you face false accusations? Please allow me. I hope this doesn't bother you that I do this 2 weeks in a row. Was it Peanuts last week? No, it was Ziggy last week. Okay, very good. Okay. Peanuts and let's see, I just got informed. Charlie Brown, and Sally. Okay. She's writing a letter. Dear. D-E-E-R. That should be D-E-A-R. In the salutation of a letter, the proper word and spelling of that word is D-E-A-R. You stupid idiot. Deer are beautiful animals found in most parts of the world. Oh my, can you get that straight? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were writing about deer. I apologize. Well, I should hope so. It seems to me that a lot of problems in this world are caused by people who criticize other people before they know what they're talking about. That's not our subject. Our subject is how do you face false accusations? That one, of course, was rather true. What are your options? How do you face false accusations? Give me some suggestions. One-word summary ideas. How do you face them?
Denial.
Okay. This probably isn't going to work, is it? Deny. Lyndon? How do you what? Okay. Prove it. In other words, reason, put forward logic, arguments, and so forth. Okay. What else?
No.
Okay. Angry? Ah, yeah, yes, yes. Will you grant this word? Attack. Yes. Okay, okay. False accusation? Okay, okay. It's called fogging, isn't it? Have you taken Lab 1 Savage? Okay, okay. Yeah, I'd say you've got to be in the Lab 1. Before we're through, I'd like to look at most of these, if not all of them, today in our study. And before you're through with life, you may need to use most of them, if not all. Option number 1, Book of Proverbs, chapter 10, page 688. How do you face false accusations? Proverbs chapter 10, verse number 19. Hilda, I think this goes with what you were saying, if I'm not mistaken. When words are many, sin is not absent, but he who holds his tongue is wise. One of the best ways that I know of to face false accusations is silence. Often your accusers do not show up publicly or personally, even when they're summoned, like Ahab. They're merely in the background somewhere whispering. And here, obviously, silence is the only way I know of to relate to it. It is truly golden because there is no sense in trying to chase clouds. Lyndon just stepped out of the room for a minute, didn't he? What a coincidence. This last week, I watched my boy do something that was very interesting. He had the week off, and he very industriously got in, found this job and that job to earn money, and he was doing this and he was doing that, and he was discovering all the bus routes all over San Diego County and getting out and experimenting how he doesn't need me for transportation. He can take a bus anywhere, he's discovered, in San Diego County, and he was just having a great time. And I had to chuckle at it a little bit because it reminded me probably of some of the things that I did when I was his age. First one thing and then another. And then I thought of the fact that he's probably going to get in trouble for it sometime. Industry, thrift, business. My major in college was business. And you know, there are some people that have the attitude that a preacher ought to be poor at everything except preaching. You know, I mean, they don't tolerate that. And if you're not absolutely poverty-stricken, if you have had a few business investments that turned out right, they wonder, you know, what in the world this guy is doing. And over the course of my life, I've gotten so tired of chasing those kind of things. And just to show you the links, the ridiculous links that I've gone at Collegedale. We built a house. One of the best investments for a pastor through the years up until the recent economy has been to build a home or to buy a home and to build up equity and savings in a home so that when he retires, he isn't just poverty stricken. Well, we built a home in Collegedale, and no sooner had we moved into this home than we began hearing the whispers and the rumors. You know? And I get so tired of that because nobody ever came to me, you know, straight off. It was always, the people are talking. You know, the people are talking. My friends are reporting. The people are talking. They're concerned. They want to know where you got your money. You know, this big, beautiful house. Of course, it's sold for about what a lot would cost here in California. You know, that's why I'm renting now. But you know how it goes. And I was so foolish that finally, in my desperation, my frustration, I took my tax return that I fill out each year. I Xeroxed it, and I sent it over to the college administrator, and I said, would you please keep this on file? I'll send you one each year and see that any questions that are circulating among the administration there are answered with the facts. I was hoping maybe it would answer his questions, too, just in case he had, you know. I wasn't sure where all the yapping was coming from. I thought he might have been part of it. But I want to tell you something. It didn't do any good. It didn't do any good. I should have just saved the effort. skipped the Xerox expense. Silence is a better option. When the Salvation Army was beginning, William Booth had many antagonists. One of the principal ones was a man by the name of Thomas Huxley, a biologist and agnostic who was writing through the columns of the London Times. Huxley launched an all-out attack upon Booth and his organization. He pictured William Booth as a manipulator of the minds of his followers, and he used in his columns over and over the phrase, prostitution of the minds, prostitution of the minds. He wrote that Booth's influence with the Salvation Army soldiers was as evil or worse than harlotry or intemperance. Others joined Huxley in his attacks upon Booth, and often these kind of things are hardest to relate to for members of the family. Booth's son, Bramwell Booth, wanted his father to do something. Do something! But the general refused, saying that he couldn't waste his time fighting his critics. He wouldn't be diverted from the work that God wanted him to do. Son, he said, 50 years from now, it will matter very little indeed how these people treated us. It will matter a great deal how we dealt with the work of God. Silence is often the best option that we have. Then keep on doing what God has called you to do. I like this little poem entitled, Do It Anyway. People are unreasonable, illogical, self-centered. Love them anyway. If you do good, people will accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Do good anyway. If you're successful, you will win false friends and true enemies. Succeed anyway. Honesty and frankness make you vulnerable. Be honest and frank anyway. The good you do today will be forgotten tomorrow. But do it anyway. The biggest people with the biggest ideas can be shot down by the smallest people with the smallest minds. Think big anyway. People favor underdogs but follow only top dogs. Fight for some underdogs anyway. What you spend years building may be destroyed overnight. Build anyway. Give the world the best you have and you'll get kicked in the teeth. Give the world the best you've got anyway. End of quote. Do you like that? I certainly do. Give it the best you've got and then be prepared to be falsely accused because it will happen. And when it does, your best option may be silence, even though that's certainly not the option that Elijah chose. Option number two. Reason. Who was this that spoke up? Lyndon, yes. That was a left brain suggestion, Lyndon. Argument. Reason. That appeals to us logical left brain people. But that doesn't always succeed. But sometimes it does. You perhaps read the story about the soldier who was in basic training learning how to use hand grenades. You know, and the corporal was really just working these guys over. He was telling them just like they knew nothing. I mean, he was going right down to the very details and saying, gentlemen, I want you to do it exactly as I tell you. Don't vary this an iota or you're going to get blown off the face of the earth. And he gave them these instructions. He says, I want you by the numbers to do this with me. And they were, you know, working with these were dummy hand grenades, I guess. He said, number one, grasp the grenade in the right hand. Number two, take the forefinger of the left hand, put it through the ring, and pull. Number three, throw. Number four, fall flat. And as they were practicing with the dummy grenades, there was one particular soldier in this group that seemed to be having trouble. His throws were not all going very far. Some of them only a measly 20 feet away. And the next morning, they were scheduled to go to the live grenade range. And throw the real thing. And they were going to get down into these 6-foot deep trenches. And then above the trench, there was another 4 feet of dirt mounded up above that was supposed to protect them from, you know, the explosion.
Billy Jones, the soldier who was having trouble throwing, the one who had thrown all the 20-foot wonders the day before, finally had his turn in the trench with the corporal. But first the corporal said, "Let's throw one more dummy." By the numbers. And so they went through it, and Billy heaved with all of his strength. The dud hit the top of the dirt, came rolling right back down at their feet. "Soldier," shouted the now perspiring corporal, "didn't you ever throw a baseball? Couldn't you throw it any farther than that?" "Sure," shrugged Billy, "but I'm left-handed." Reason may be an option for you if you are facing false accusations, unless the corporal is screaming so loudly that he can't even hear you. But I would warn you, be careful to use this one very sparingly, because frequently accusers are not really interested in reasons. That only makes them more angry. Now, there are several other options that are kind of closely related to this one, but I've chosen to number them differently because while they're closely related, they're a little bit different. Elijah might have chosen on this particular occasion to excuse himself and to just plead for mercy. I don't know what you would call that, but just, "Oh, I'm sorry, King, for all the problems I've caused. Oh, maybe this is fogging. This is fogging. Please, please have mercy on me and I won't do it again." You know? But he didn't choose that. Elijah might have chosen Evasion. He might have said to the king, "Hey, king, I got some good news for you. Guess what? The drought's almost over. Let's talk about something else. Think about all the rain that's going to be falling soon." Evasion. Or Elijah might have chosen another option that we could call flattery. Flattery. "King, you know, I'm sorry, but you are a wonderful fellow," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The philosopher Diogenes was washing lentils to make soup. He was noticed by a second philosopher by the name of Aristippus, who had acquired a rather comfortable living by paying court to the king. Aristippus sneered at Diogenes and said, "If you would only learn to flatter the king, you wouldn't have to live on such poor food as lentils." "If you had learned to live on such food as lentils," retorted Diogenes, just as disdainfully, "you would not have to flatter the king." Now, Elijah didn't choose that option either. None of the above. Although one or more of those options may be the best for you at times. What did he do? 1 Kings 18, verse number 18, page 380. What would you call this? "I haven't made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals." Is that silence? Is that flattery? What would you call that? Certainly not evasion. Attack. I'd call that attack. In fact, that has to be option number 6. There's no question about it. I mean, this is attack. Here's the appeal was under all sorts of barrage from his peers right after he had written the book, The Power of Positive Thinking. He was so discouraged that he was thinking of quitting the ministry, just giving it all up. He went to visit his father. His father was a retired Methodist minister. I don't think his father's still living now, but at the time his father was still alive. And he was pouring out his soul to his dad, telling him all the problems he was facing and his discouragement and how he was thinking of quitting. And his father said to him, "Norman, I've followed you all your life. You've always preached the gospel. You've always remained true to Jesus Christ. You're sound. There's only one thing left that you can do for your critics." "What's that?" Norman asked his father. "Tell those people to go to hell." I mean, that is kind of option number six, isn't it? Basically, it is attack. And, you know, while Elijah wasn't quite that graphic, although he certainly could have been, he was at other times, he said it just about that plain. I haven't made trouble for Israel, but you and your father's family have. You have forsaken the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. I mean, that is attack, isn't it? Do you detect the prophetic note that runs through this little exchange? Is it you, you troubler of Israel? I haven't troubled Israel, but you and your father's family have because you've forsaken the commandments of the Lord and followed Baal. Ah, next week I would like to deal exclusively with the prophetic application of those particular exchange, this particular exchange. But for now, would you notice with me that Elijah was not silent. He didn't try reason. He didn't try to excuse himself or to evade or to flatter. Elijah faced this particular false accusation with all guns blazing. You know, in one sense, Ahab might have felt like he had just run into the battleship Missouri. Or to update, let's see, aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk. Can you imagine what it would be like to be in a rowboat, be run over by the Kitty Hawk, coming on at, you know, top speed. There you are in your little rowboat. What? Kind of devastating, wouldn't it? Literally. I have a feeling that Ahab might not have expected the response that he gotten from the prophet, although maybe he should have. I don't know. But anyway, he certainly was hit. And you know, about this point in this particular study this week, I started cringing, and I've been cringing all week long. Because when you look at the options that we have for facing false accusations and you bring up this one, you're certainly dealing with the most dangerous option of the bunch. And the fear that I had and have is that anybody would go from here and say, hey, that's the option I'm supposed to always use. Oh, please, no. If you use this option, make certain before you do it that you are the Lord's spokesman and you're not just acting in angry retaliation because you got your feelings hurt. Most of the attacks that you and I have participated in have come because of that, because of hurt feelings, and we just wanted to retaliate, not because we're really speaking up for the Lord. And so much of what we need to experience in growth in Christ is pulls away from this option that it's difficult to even talk about it. It's a little bit like the subject of child training. You deal with the subject of child training, you talk about disciplining your child, you talk about spanking your child, and some people will go from the meeting and think that they're justified in child abuse. Do you know what I mean? In battering their children. When that is so far from the truth of what we're talking about, there's just no connection at all. And yet, the damage could be done through a misunderstanding, if you follow what I mean. And it is here the same way. None of us are very comfortable with confrontation. The little experience that I've had at it has been negative, both on the receiving and on the giving end, not too successful. So I think that we all naturally kind of cringe here. And well, we might. The last thing that a discouraged sinner needs is more condemnation. And a person who is attacking you falsely, who is falsely accusing you, I should say, not to confuse us a little bit, a person who is falsely accusing you is guilty deep down in some side somewhere and realizes that and does not need condemnation from you coming back and attacking them. So mark it down. This is not the option for most circumstances. I'm much more comfortable with our philosophy of love, acceptance, and forgiveness, aren't you? That would lend toward the concept of option number one, silence. And perhaps, but very rarely, reason and some logic. But you know something? Love, acceptance, and forgiveness, if we're not careful, can simply amount to permissiveness. And somehow we've got to walk that delicate line. An embezzler is welcome at North Coast Christian Fellowship, but we have got to still stand firmly some way for honesty. An adulterer or an adulteress is welcome here where they ought to be, but we've still got to stand for moral purity. A drunk may worship here and in fact have full membership here. And yet at the same time, somehow we have got to stand for sobriety. We stand for temperance in eating and drinking even good things. But the intemperate are welcome here. And probably that's good because all of us fall into that category at one time or another. You may have battered and beaten your wife or your child this week. You're still welcome here. But we stand for self-control. Your insides may be full of envy and jealousy, but you're still welcome here. Because while we stand for the Spirit's fruits of love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control, if membership here were really limited to those only who always have such, no one could belong. And what we've done often in the past is merely expelled people based upon the fact that they were not having the same problem that we seem to be having. You know, the more subtle sins, which are sometimes the more difficult ones. Greed, pride. But the thing that I want to register clearly is that there should be no question about our goals. Our goal, obedience to God for the right reasons, coming from a heart that loves. Other churches, even other Adventist Christian churches, may choose different means, but if our goals are the same, we can still be part of the same family. So when is this option number 6, the proper one in dealing with a false accuser? Probably only when your accuser is Ahab. Or may I say, an Ahab. Otherwise, I really believe that we'll all be better off in the long run to stick with the other 5. Even flattery would be less destructive than this one. Or to put it another way, it depends a little bit upon whether God is attempting to use you to comfort the afflicted or to afflict the comfortable. Both are needed. And you know what? I haven't hardly seen anybody who can do both. Seems like the same instrument just cannot cut both ways. God has to work through different instruments because this is such a specialized tool. It just doesn't fly both directions. And so if you have to make a choice between comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable, I would encourage you to choose to comfort. And that's what I'd like for this fellowship to be known for. Not as a place of affliction. Choose to comfort, because once you get beneath the surface, most people that I know of already have sufficient affliction. They don't need any more of that. Don't you agree? Sheila, sing for us.